On this episode of Comedy Rewind, has Kevin Smith's Clerks lost all its shock value after 25 years? Have independent comedies become less relevant with the rise of YouTube? Is there anything more dated than a thriving video rental store? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to Comedy Rewind, the rewatch podcast on the 8-Bit Collective. Thanks to all our Patreon supporters, you made it happen, and I'm here, John O'Peck, your host, joined by the hosts of the BitStorm podcast, the Jay and Silent Bob of the 8-Bit Collective, I guess.
Which one's the silent one?
It's true. That Ben Slinger and Trevor Scott. Yeah, maybe it's Jay and Randall's probably more accurate.
I've got the hair. I've got the Jay hair. It's not blonde, but it's pretty long.
Yeah,
Trevor's got a bit of a silent Bob vibe going on.
I've got the coat.
You're like the true, silent Bob, true. Maybe in Chasing Amy when he decides to talk for like 3 minutes straight.
Trevor does talk. Yeah, thanks for having us. We're very glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you here. You guys want to give a quick plug to what your show is all about?
BitStorm is a comedy game design podcast by two guys, that's Trevor and I, who know nothing about comedy nor game design. And each week we generally take random words and turn them into game designs that are funny or interesting, and then we throw them away and do a few more.
It's great fun.
And the good thing is you can jump in at the latest episode. There's no storyline to go with.
Yep.
Occasionally we do some callbacks, but then you just have to go for a choose your own adventure and find out which episodes it was that we referenced.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, Clerks is a movie that you guys are a bit older than me, so I'm hoping it probably means a bit more to you as people that maybe grew up with it. I came to it much later in life. I should say we're talking about Clerks today. If that's not obvious enough from the episode title and the thumbnail and everything, we're talking about Kevin Smith's Clerks, a melodramatic day in the life of two store clerks in New Jersey. Yeah, so what are your early memories of this film?
Before I rewatched it yesterday, I took some notes because I didn't want to taint my memories with the rewatch. I wanted to sort of go back in time and remember. But so it came out in 1994. I was 13 at the time. So I didn't actually see it when it sort of was first released. Like, it's not something I saw at the movie. It was rated R. Yeah,
probably still too young.
But I do remember seeing it and being intrigued by it on the shelves of my local video store. You know, the old big chunky VHS cases.
Absolutely. There's lots of them in this movie.
Exactly, yes. So that was really my first memory of it, and I remember seeing it up there on the wall and had the sort of the funky writing and stuff. And then for me it wasn't until I think I saw Chasing Amy and maybe even Morat before then going back and seeing Clerks. I think Chasing Amy was the first Kevin Smith film that I saw. But then I don't know, maybe 16, 17. And then it became a classic, right? Then it was, that's sort of the right age for that sort of thing, and the humor and the filthiness of it, and how sort of just shameless it was around a lot of the things.
What about you, Trevor?
Well, my parents had Optus Vision, the like the Kmart version of Foxtel back in the day, in around 96, and one day I'm surfing around movie one, movie two, and I see this black and white film come up and I'm immediately wanting to switch
black and white
to the next channel. But then I heard the word Star Wars and they were in the middle of the Star Wars scene. And I'm like, I think I might just sit down and watch the rest of this. And then as soon as it finished, I went on to movie 1+2, which was the 2 hours later version, and watched the whole movie again.
That's great.
And yeah, so I didn't know anything about it going in and just sat there gobsmacked. Like, it was just an amazing experience to see for the first time and realizing that I liked a black and white comedy.
How old were you?
16.
Yeah,
so 96.
So old enough to watch it almost
ish.
I think I was like 19 or 20 when I first saw it, and it was very much something that I'd heard of. There was, you know, there's obviously a kind of a mythos around it as the origin. It's kind of the genesis of Kevin Smith's career, really. It's his propelling him into stardom and into becoming essentially one of the most popular filmmaking personalities we've ever had, from very humble beginnings. it's really the ultimate low budget success story, and I think it's been an inspiration to so many people because of just the nature in which it was created, where, you know, Kevin Smith, as we know, had $27,000 to make it, and he maxed out something like 10 credit cards and
sold off his comic book collection. And
yeah, and it was filmed where he worked during the day, and then at night he went in and filmed until like 4 a.m. and then got up the next day, probably feeling much like Dante does at the start of the movie. So yeah, I guess that there's kind of that
what do you want?
It's like a almost like a purple haze around this film for especially for film buffs. And I just, you know, you heard references to it, and then I finally watched it after, probably similar to you, Ben, having seen like Dogma or something else before. Yeah. And you knowing like that it all started with Clerks. So from that point of view, I think you kind of need that context to watch it, knowing that it was the beginning. And to me, in that sense, it's almost like going back and listening to your favorite band's early EP or something, where things are a bit dirty and the instruments aren't quite in tune, or it wasn't mixed or mastered properly. So it's very rough around the edges, and you kind of have to appreciate that when you rewatch it, I think.
Yeah, yeah, you definitely have to come into it. You know, you can't just take it at its face value now. I realize 25 years later, almost exactly, later this year will be the 25-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to go in knowing, oh, this is a low-budget film. It was made literally in a convenience store on actual film. That you can imagine how expensive and why you had to max all that stuff out. Like, you think about it today, and I know we're going to sort of get to this later, but you could film this on an iPhone today, right?
And it would be look better
quality. Yeah. The technology just wasn't there, so...
Yeah.
Well, it also, you know, the budget just determined whether it's going to be color or black and white. They realized they could get more black and white film for the money rather than half the amount for color.
Yeah, I read that the black and white was mostly influenced by not being able to get consistent lighting in different scenes or in different settings, sorry. And so that black and white kind of masks over that issue. So quite ingenious and thrifty decision there from Kevin Smith.
Well, that's it. And it's such an interesting film because... it doesn't feel like other films in a lot of ways. And part of that is that there is sort of this, you know, this amateur vibe running through it. Although some of the performances I found were actually, like, I remembered them being worse than they were.
yep.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it, of course, it's so much of just the talking heads, you know, two people talking, that the performances... you know, really, I guess they could have been more subtle and they could have been a bit more nuanced. But I remember the stuttering and the kind of the cadence of it as very much this amateur kind of amateur actors. Just they've learned their lines off by off by heart and they're just reeling them off. But it wasn't as jarring as I recalled.
It's a good point you make. Like, there's a sense, like it feels sometimes like they're just basically mouthpieces for Kevin Smith talking. And I get the same kind of feeling when I watch Aaron Sorkin movies and the dialogue where it's all snappy and they're all like, they all know exactly what to say and it's back and forth. And especially when Dante's kind of sitting there talking to his girlfriend. And I don't know if it's because of the amateur actors or it's just what Kevin Smith was aiming for. But it loses a little bit of realism despite the awesome dialogue that he'd written, I think.
Well, that's it. There's just something about the, like, how quick people come back with the next line.
Yeah.
Sometimes quicker than would make sense, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a natural flowing conversation. But you're right. Like, the lines themselves, the script itself is so snappy and funny, you kind of forgive it, I guess.
I've got an early hot take on this, and it's that I didn't find it incredibly funny as a rewatch. We're talking about comedies here. A lot of it is about the humor itself. But I feel like, as much as I appreciated it for how important it was, and I do think it's a really authentic look at 90s adulthood, but the humor is a lot of it probably coming from the shock value of seeing people talk in this kind of realistic way and openly discussing sex and relationships and drugs and whatever it is. I feel like watching it now, that stuff has been done so much more that it doesn't hold the same humor or the same shock value that it would have at the time. Does that ring true for you guys?
Yeah, for sure. The shock value definitely is in there. It was just hard for me as well. As I think Trevor said, I've watched it so many times now that there aren't any surprises. So it is hard to put yourself in the mindset of watching it for the first time. So it would be really interesting actually to show it to someone for the first time now who's used to modern movies and get their point of view, you know.
Watching it again, I still laugh at all the things that I've always laughed at, but it may just be my memory of, you know, 37 or something like that. Yeah. It always just makes me laugh. Like,
I mean, it's possible. Like, I watched Happy Gilmore for that episode one and laughed at stupid stuff that I laughed at when I was a kid. So maybe it's bringing it back for you, whereas I watched this as an adult, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and for us, it's become so much a part of our kind of vernacular.
Yeah.
Like, still, to this day, you hear anything with the number 37. And particularly if I'm around Trevor or some of our friends, like, all you have to do is just say 37, and they know exactly what you're going at. And they may come back with try not to suck any dicks on the way through the parking lot. But they don't have to. You know, it's not as necessary.
37 in a row? Wow.
Yeah, in a row.
Speaking of 37, do you guys know what this was on Rotten Tomatoes?
No,
I didn't look.
I haven't looked it up.
Let's hear some guesses. Like, what do you think the reception would have been at the time?
Oh, at the time. Because do they only take a certain time period after release?
I think
release?
It's kind of current, like when the movie came out.
I'd say it's fresh. So I'll go 74.
Yeah, I would think it would be fresh.
It is fresh, yes.
Yeah, I'm going to say sort of, around 80-ish.
It was 88. Actually.
Okay.
88.
Yeah.
Wow.
I thought that it would be lower based on just how crass it is and the kind of amateurish.
It was a bit of a critical darling at the time because of, I think, just how different it was. And it, like, you know, they showed it at Sundance and it was sort of this underdog coming out of nowhere. So,
that makes sense.
I'm not entirely surprised. But it's true. Like, you wouldn't expect it from a modern sort of point of view that a movie like that would be so critically acclaimed.
Yeah, and I guess it was kind of an era of the breakout of the indie movie where even, you know, it was also the era of grunge as well, where you're like, oh, people can do this thing, they can go big without going through the studios, or they can do it off their own bat, and it might have been becoming a bit more woke for the time to appreciate what can be done off your own back.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find quite interesting is one of the DVD sets I have has the original cut and it also has like the theatrical cut. The original cut still doesn't have all the music because that was added after Sundance. So it makes me wonder whether people reviewed the film from Sundance, which didn't have a lot of the music that we're now used to hearing in the film, and how different that would be. And I was going to watch it today, but I didn't quite have the time to find a region-free DVD player.
Now, does that original cut have the original ending?
Yes, it
where
does.
Dante gets murdered, basically?
Yeah, Dante gets shot just after sort of Randall leaves at the end.
Which is such a downer, and I'm so glad that it got removed.
Yep.
And not only because then we get to see Dante show up in later films, and specifically in Clerks 2, but I feel like it's actually got quite a good ending. And again, this might be nostalgia, but there's just a certain feeling to each sort of segment of the movie. It really does have an emotional arc, even though, I don't know, so a lot of it is disconnected. And I mean, intentionally so, you know, you get those title cards coming up with each little section, and it's sort of, they're separated in that way. But the feeling after they have their big fight and they sort of make up and Randall struts out the door, the ending just works. It just feels, I don't know, it's sort of an uplifting feeling to that ending. And to then just have someone come in and shoot him and leave him for dead.
I wonder if, I don't think that they would have, the reviews would have been on that version at the 88% fresh. Yeah. So.
No, I suspect not.
Yeah, but it's just very interesting to know that there's two different cuts out there, and the original cut is sans music, because music was part of the big budget that was added by Miramax.
Well, and I find that interesting because the music to me is a big part of it, and I actually made a note of like the music choices are really, they really help the movie, you know. To me, they're kind of, they're an integral part of each of those scenes. And yeah, I haven't seen the cut without it, so that would be actually really interesting to watch.
Definitely.
Speaking of music, the number one song when the movie was released was Boys to Men, I'll Make Love to You, which is at the top of the charts for 14 weeks. Pretty good effort there from the boys. So that's just to kind of set the scene of where things were at in 94.
That's a really good thing to bring up on this show. It really kind of gives you that sense of the time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially for those people who were alive in the 90s, or at least, you know, a teenager in the 90s, you sort of remember, oh, I remember when that song came out, and, you know, going through probably, what, year 7, year 8 at the time.
Yeah, I think music is one of those things that teleports you back instantly, and that's why, like, any time you watch a movie where there's, like, a flashback to, like, 1970 or something, like, instantly it starts with a song from that year, and it always kind of sets the scene.
Definitely.
So the next question is, what have you done for me lately? And for pretty much everyone in this film, the answer is not much. I know that Kevin Smith's continued to make films, but the pace has kind of slowed down, and the Askewniverse products have also tapered off, and it's not really until Jay and Silent Bob 2 comes out shortly that we're going to see what's happening in that world again. I think, what was the last time? Was it Clerks 2?
Clerks 2 was the last Askewniverse film.
Which is more than 10 years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah, 2006.
Yeah.
Everyone in the film has continued to work, like, I guess from the main cast, but you have to say they're well known and almost only known for what they've done in Kevin Smith movies.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, particularly the side characters, you know, half of them are just his friends from high school.
Yeah.
Or his mum. Well, actually, I have a note here of noticing Walt Flanagan in two roles, in two scenes, one after the other.
Yeah.
You know, he's the guidance counselor trying to get the perfect dozen eggs, and then immediately after he's there getting offended as Randall talks about juice moppers.
Yeah, that was really jarring that they just went from that one scene to the next. I was like, are we supposed to notice this? They didn't even really put a fake moustache on him or anything.
And, I mean, Scott Mosier was in there quite a few times. There was one scene where he was down the bottom as like, Willem, and up the top as the guy fighting to get into the store. So, and he had a beard and one he didn't, and you could tell it was filmed at a totally different time.
It's funny because he probably thought at the time, no one's going to recognize this guy. But now he's somewhat of a celebrity. We know Scott Mosier from whether it's his work with Kevin Smith or the podcast, and it's like, there's Scott again, and there's Scott again.
yeah, exactly.
So what was the most 90s moment for you guys?
I mean, just obviously the fact that Randall works in a video store pretty much dates it.
Yeah. RST. That's
pretty heavily. RST video.
I mean, it could have also happened in 2002 or 2004 and still been, like, we were still renting
videos.
That's true.
It's more the fact that there was a video store, and when he had to call up the distributor to get videos, it was on a landline. Not on a mobile phone, or at least on a cordless or something like that. So it really locked it into the 90s for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look, I'm not a big fashion person as such, but there were definitely some hairstyles and some fashion choices that that felt pretty 90s
of the time,
in there.
Yep.
Yeah. I had a very specific moment for me, and it was using what looks like a payphone, but I guess it's like the staff phone in the clerks in the quick stop to check a misprint in the classifieds engagement notices. Like, that is like peak 90s just about.
Yes, that's
with,
true.
Just absolutely, with the newspaper and like, okay.
Well, even just the fact that, that the engagement notice is in a newspaper.
Yep. And I mean, that is a kind of traditional thing. I got married in 2013, and my parents and my wife's parents did this, I guess it's a tradition where they both pay half to get this classified. They're announcing the engagement. So I guess that is still a thing, but it surprised me. So I guess that shows that it's a thing from a previous era. You know,
previous
the fact that it was something my parents wanted to do it and I had never heard of it. That's my favorite thing. And I also had the fact that there's a video store there, and you know how thriving it is. There's like customers all day just coming in,
like literally waiting there for it to open so they can get a specific movie.
Oh, there you go. Another most 90s moment is when the guy in the video store name checks Navy SEALs.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was.
Yeah, there aren't too many pop culture references in there. Surprisingly, actually, for Kevin Smith, obviously, there's the Star Wars discussion. Yep. But yeah, that's probably the only other big one.
And I did notice some of the films behind them during that scene. One of them was Death yeah. Becomes Her, which is very, very 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and there were a few others that I can't remember right off the top of my head. I just remember seeing it like in three different spots because they had like three copies behind them.
It was a popular movie.
Yeah. It must have been. Bruce Willis, Gina Davis, yeah. I think. Yeah.
There you go. It's the first time Bruce Willis was in a Kevin Smith film. And later they go on to make, you know, Cop Out, which Kevin Smith is still trying to forget about, I think. But
yeah, I actually saw Kevin Smith when I was in America. Like he did his live performance, An Evening with Kevin Smith, and talked extensively yep. about working with Bruce Willis and how he never wanted to do it again. Most iconic scene. What did you guys have?
I don't know. I love the 37. I love all the Jay and Silent Bob scenes. I think they're fantastic. Like Berserker and all those sort of
they're great little interstitials. It's amazing how far Jay and Silent Bob have come, considering how small a part they actually have in this movie.
Yep, but 100% the most iconic scene to me has to be like a scene that's not even in the film. It's the funeral scene. Like it doesn't happen in the film, but it's you see before and after. And it's just that sort of the discussion around it that makes it quite iconic to me, that it makes me feel like I've always seen what actually happened there, even though it was like many years later that they finally showed it.
Yeah, that's interesting. What did you have, Ben?
So I wrote some stuff down before I watched it again, just to sort of use my key memories from it. And funnily enough, the whole intro sequence to me is very iconic for it, because it really does, it sets the tone for the movie in a big way. It's got the music going, it's sort of, he's setting up all the stuff and he's, you know, the locks are jammed and he's doing the shoe polish and he's getting stealing the papers from the whatever and getting his quarterback. And I don't know, that whole sequence, and again, this might just be a lot of nostalgia from watching it so many times, but it really just gets me into that mood for this film. It like kicks it off, and then he's behind the counter, and you know, his day starts, and that's felt yeah, very iconic to me.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with you, well, both of you in some aspects, because I've jotted down three contenders for this question. The first one was the opening scene. I think it's so relatable, getting that phone call that's asking you to come into work or whatever it might be. It might be someone saying, can you come over and help me like move house, or like there's just, we can all relate to not wanting to get out of bed but having to go and do something that we don't want to do. Yeah. And it really is kind of the theme of the movie as well, so I find that is quite iconic. And the 37, you mentioned that, yep. Trevor. It's hard to go past that. But something that hasn't been mentioned yet, the Star Wars contractors conversation, that exchange is something that pretty much encapsulates Kevin Smith in a lot of ways, and kind of is almost the biggest thing that points towards what the future of his movies is going to be.
It's
like.
True. I had that on my list too, actually, as a contender. And one of the things, I mean, he's known for talking about Star Wars, obviously, in his movies and pop culture in general and comic books. One of the most interesting things about that, though, is, of course, the discussion was before any of the prequels, before any of the further sequels, before any of the extended universe stuff, like really all that was there was the three movies. But it's still so relevant. You know, 25 years later, everyone's still talking about Star Wars, and that's still an interesting conversation.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And I guess just that digging into the minutiae of like, okay, contractors, you know, do they deserve to die? Do they not deserve to die? Like that is such a kind of a Kevin Smith thing. Oh, it's also a very like Tarantino-esque kind of thing. And that was kind of in the zeitgeist of the time to maybe start digging into those conversations in film. So to me, that stood out a lot. And because knowing Clerks 2 is coming and the kinds of conversations that happen in that film, it stood out to me as kind of setting the table for what we're going to get a bit later on.
Yeah, he definitely doubled down in Clerks 2 on yeah. a lot of that sort of stuff.
So what do you reckon holds up the best in Clerks?
I'd have to say the friendship between Randall and Dante, actually, it rings true. So therefore, to me, it feels like it's one of the better things of the entire movie. Even though they have a fight during it, you can still see the friendship between them.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't considered that. It might be, again, knowing what comes in Clerks 2 and seeing it's kind of like we're seeing the, not the origin, because they've clearly been friends for a while, but we're seeing earlier days and knowing that they remain friends for a long time kind of makes that a bit more relevant. But it definitely gives you the sense that not only do they know each other really well, but they're the kind of friends that can have a fight and make up and kind of look out for each other, even though they're both very selfish in their own ways and not afraid of kind of hurting each other. I guess we can also maybe relate to those types of friendships, especially in the younger, stupider years that we've all experienced.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I hadn't thought of that either as something that holds up, but that is a really good point, Trevor. Yeah, I agree. Like having that friend who kind of calls you on your shit, like Randall does, and just sort of says it like it is, and that does tend to, I mean, for Randall it didn't, as we see in Clerks 2, but that does tend to go away a bit, I think, as you get older. So it is sort of that age, early 20s, and people, I don't know, kind of haven't necessarily matured out of that sort of behavior yet, but that it works well for that friendship and kind of the friendship does ring true. I agree.
That's a good point. And it's also a period in your life where clearly, from what we see with Dante, he is making lots of poor choices. And not that we're all perfect when we get older. We still make bad choices. But that's really a time where I guess people are figuring out who they are. That's, I think, a pretty big theme of this movie is that young adulthood and the stupid things people do and the way they treat each other and the way they talk to each other. And seeing, like you said, they're looking out for each other. They're giving advice, they're calling people out when they need to.
Yep.
And yeah, you're right. Like that's a time where people need that because it's when you're becoming who you're going to be as an adult.
Yeah. Whether it's that you went to high school together and are still friends or college friends or, you know, what have you, your friends are so formative in that time, right? That's who forms so much of your personality and helps you to find your way. You know, generally before, as you get older, it tends to be more of a, you know, whether you're in a romantic relationship with someone or whatever, like that's who sort of drives you in that way. In your 20s, it's definitely your friends.
Yep. The other thing that I thought held up really well was, surprisingly, the choice of black and white. I think if it was color at this stage with inconsistent lighting, it wouldn't have that same sort of appeal to me. Like,
there's a nostalgia attached to it too.
I can sit there through a black and white and it helps the nostalgia, whereas, you know, poor lighting would actually harm my enjoyment of this film. So I think the black and white is actually another thing that makes this film hold up and keeps me going back for rewatches.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because you're right, like using it to cover that up, if you'd look back at it now, it would just feel like a super amateur, you know, early first film.
It would feel like a $27,000 movie instead of...
Yeah, you know.
Instead of... It sits very, very nicely alongside Chasing Amy, which is a $250,000 picture, but you can sort of still see that if they had that sort of budget, like the $250,000, it would be basically okay to have Clerks in colour. Yeah.
I had the relationship advice from Jay and Silent Bob. I find that like when that scene happened, I was like, yeah, that's so true. And I probably still know people that need to hear something like that, you know?
Yeah.
The other bit of dialogue that held up for me was the anti-cigarette speech comparing the clerk to Nazis, because that happens all the time on the internet.
That's true.
It's like, you know, what's the... Anyone that's following orders, you're a Nazi. You're a fascist, you know. It's a very early scene in the film, and one that... It was one of the few that... I guess I hadn't seen the movie for a while, so I didn't remember it was coming, and it made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, that's always good.
And it's the first of many, many references to Nazis that Kevin Smith would then put into his later career, especially in the podcast.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah, he doesn't shy away from throwing on a terrible German accent. I guess if you can't make fun of Nazis, you can.
There's something that I had, and this is going to segue really well into what holds up the worst, because the conversation is both the best and worst of what holds up, and that's the Empire versus Jedi discussion. I think the opinion that Empire Strikes Back is the better of the Star Wars movies, I think that holds up really well. That seems like the consensus now, just about. Whereas Randall saying that it's Return of the Jedi, that doesn't hold up well for me at all.
Yeah, I feel like you'd be hard-pressed to find any big Star Wars fan defending Return of the Jedi that strongly.
Definitely not.
So what did you guys have for holding up the worst?
I think the whole Caitlin Bree having sex with a dead guy really felt a little bit too much on the nose for me. Didn't quite fit her character.
I mean, look, and that was always a bit out there.
Yep.
How can it not be?
Yeah, well, that's it. Like, that was always a shocking scene. I'm not sure that it's that... to me, it's not that it doesn't hold up. It's more that, yeah, it was always a shocking scene and always kind of fucked up.
Yeah. Does it not hold up that it's kind of played for laughs, where, like, they do acknowledge that it's something that's going to scar her for life, but I don't know. Is it something that now, if it was in a film, you'd kind of go, that's a mark against the movie?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it kind of shows its age in the fact that you could never see that in a comedy movie nowadays. Yeah,
that is true. I will definitely concede that I think you'd be hard pressed even in an R-rated movie to get that scene in there now.
As much as I love it, the Jizzmopper scene, I don't think you'd ever hear that sort of comedy again in an R-rated film. Maybe an NC-17. They seem to go a little bit more PC.
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether we're going by Australian or American rating things, but. I don't know. I feel like that could make its way into you know, a very adult film, like a Seth Rogen kind of R-rated
or something.
Judd Apatow something.
But they definitely wouldn't have an uncensored bloody vagina on the screen or a vulva.
That's true.
Yeah, That did happen. I'd forgotten about that. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it in all its HD glory.
Oh, man.
Yeah, look, for me, some of the jokes... there are a few homophobic and transphobic jokes, which, you know, again, at the time, there just wasn't that awareness as such of how damaging that can be. And Randall comes back from Big Store, Big Choice Video, with hermaphroditic porn and goes on, that really would not fly today and kind of made me cringe.
Best of both worlds, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I was pleasantly surprised with how few jokes there were that sort of punched down in that way, or that were just, you know, not, that were unaware, that were of their time. It doesn't rely on sexism or homophobia, you know, very much at all.
That's a good point. I thought that the women got a pretty fair shake as far as being the ones that were probably in the right for most of those discussions. Like, I didn't feel like he was, you know, trying to make any comments about women being crazy or that kind of thing.
No, exactly. Yeah.
The characters might have been thinking that, but we could see that they were the ones that were wrong.
Yes. Yeah. No, I agree with that. And Kevin Smith, you know, is quite good with this in general. He didn't rely on too many sexist tropes about women and you know, particularly around sex and that sort of thing. They kind of had their own reasons for everything that made sense. And
yeah, I also had the gay slurs not holding up great. And as you mentioned, it was a clearly different social context at the time in the 90s. But after watching this, I was watching Aziz Ansari's latest comedy special, and he makes the point that even in The Hangover, which was only something like 7 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, the same gay slurs were used in the trailer for that movie, and nobody really batted an eyelid or kicked up a stink about it. So even in that short amount of time, we've come quite a long way as far as what's acceptable and what's considered offensive.
I agree. It's really been the last, you know, latter half of this last decade even, you know, I've been rewatching Community, and Pierce is constantly calling things gay, and I mean, that's obviously part of his character in that sense. But even so, I feel like being made today, and that's within the past, you know, past decade, just about. I don't think it would get past, you know.
Yeah, that's curious. Yeah, interesting. And I don't know, like, I think there's room for characters who are bad people to be on shows, because it's kind of shining a light on the fact that it's not appropriate to talk in certain ways. So yeah. I don't know if we need to do away with that altogether. But then again, I'm not one of the people that is the target of those jokes. So it's maybe not for me to say.
It's true. And I think it really comes down to whether that the usage of something like that, even if it's a shitty person, is then normalizing that or actually exploring it in some useful, critical way.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess that's where context is always the key. So
yeah,
it can go both ways. So one of the last things that I had as holding up badly was, I thought the physical gags in the movie, there weren't a lot of them, but there were a few, like Dante sleeping in the closet at the start of the movie. The fight in the shop where I think one of them grabs a breadstick and hits the other guy. Like, it's kind of funny, but then like the rest of the movie being so realistic, those things kind of stood out to me as kind of hammy and a bit kind of corny for a movie like this.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that, but I agree. It comes off as a bit too cartoonish.
Yeah.
For the rest
I can
of the
see
movie.
Like, I can see Kevin Smith sitting there thinking this will be funny. And maybe it was, but it's a little jarring, like, to add that kind of Looney Tunes style humor to something that's in every other aspect completely realistic. And I guess Jay, his whole character kind of pulls you out of that every time he talks. Like, a person like that just can't exist.
It's true. And look, so many of the... I mean, he's interesting because a lot of the gay slurs came from Jay with his sort of just spouting off his verbal diarrhea. Mm. But yeah, I don't know. He's such a character. Whether he is very cartoonish, and he's sort of this weird, you know, misogynist, sex-driven cartoon character in these movies. Not that you necessarily forgive it, but I just, he's such I don't know, one of a kind. How do you do Jay without Jay?
Yeah, that's it. And we all kind of knew someone when we were in high school that was that hyper kind of over-sexualized, like,
it's
hyperactive.
That's true, just, actually. It's not entirely unrealistic.
Probably medicated.
Yeah.
So who would be the most offended by this film in 2019? I know you guys are very socially aware. You changed the name of your podcast because you didn't want to offend people. So you're coming kind of from a background where you are thinking about these things. So I'm interested what you think about a film that you love, you know, grew up with. Who do you think that there's a part of the world that probably wouldn't be happy about seeing this happen now?
Look, I'm not sure anyone new would be offended by it that wasn't offended by it when it came out, other than the homophobic and transphobic stuff that we've already spoken about. I think that's really the key change in sort of awareness. There are definitely going to be people who are offended by a lot of the jokes and a lot of the scenes in this movie, but they were probably offended by it 25 years ago.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep.
I thought that there was a couple like shots at Chinese people that probably didn't need to be in there. Like, there's a joke about opium, which is, you know, a stereotype from years and years and years ago. Just the fact that they continually say, like, Asian design major. Like, it's always just the emphasis on the fact that this person's Asian, which it's not malicious in and of itself, but it kind of makes you think, like, are they, or is it, like, are they making fun of the fact that she's engaged to an Asian
it's
guy?
It's interesting because I think even the article says Asian design major, like, in the paper.
In the newspaper.
And maybe it would have, I don't know, at the time. Yeah, but that's true. That probably, that's something that would definitely cause offense. And it's just unnecessary.
Trevor, you're going to say something.
I definitely think that even if you were, like, offended by one scene, it doesn't stick around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a couple of scenes in there that you go, oh my God, that's kind of offensive. And then it's never sort of talked about again. So it's not like a through line that actually happens throughout this film, except for the Asian design major. So I'm sort of with Ben. I don't think anyone knew really would be offended nowadays, but I think if you were offended 25 years ago, you're still going to be offended now.
Yeah, I guess people that would be most offended would be people who don't like hearing the types of conversations that are happening constantly throughout this movie.
People who don't like the C word, because that's said a few times in the in the video title.
Yes, it is. Interesting. I read a trivia note that he refused to speak those dialogue with the kid actually in the room. So they had to kind of do it with two different...
Which is
fair.
Yeah,
that's fair.
It's very thoughtful. But
happy, scrappy hero pop.
Oh, man.
Trevor, how dare you? That's disgusting.
So does Clerks pass the internet relevancy test via memes and GIFs? I think the kind of black and white and low res nature means that they don't hold up so well in GIFs and that kind of thing. What did you guys think?
I did do a few searches. I typed in Randall and it was like the fifth GIF down. Yep. I typed in Dante and it was like the fifth or sixth GIF down. So it's still there. Like, you can still find stuff.
Yeah.
You can find them.
But I was thinking, okay, what's the most quotable thing? And I'm like, 37. I typed in 37 and it wasn't even on the first page. Yeah.
No.
So it's not quite as quotable.
I think
and
it's such a non-visual film in so many ways that there aren't those sorts of scenes that really make their way into GIFs. And, you know, the quotes definitely do just in a text nature or, you know, in conversation. As I said, it's still something that our friends bring up. But from a meme point of view, yeah, I definitely don't recall seeing Clerks memes pop up anywhere ever.
Yeah, I think there are some lines that have kind of kept it relevant in terms of, I guess, being memorable. I assure you we're open and I'm not even supposed to be here today. Mm. Are a couple that you kind of hear thrown around. But as far as translating into memes, and when I ask this question, it's really like there are some go-to reactions and memes that you just see from movies, and like Lord of the Rings has a million of them, and there's other comedies that we're going to get to in this podcast that are going to come up. But I think that it fails this test. And it, surprisingly, if you type in Clerks, like most of the GIFs or GIFs that come up are from Clerks 2. And I think being color and, you know, there's a lot of Jay and Silent Bob and...
Well, and there's dance numbers and there's, you know, it's so much more visual for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to see a good Berserker. I feel like it's a good reaction GIF of some kind.
Yeah, okay. I don't know how you get them into the system to make them come up. I'm always bewildered by that, and I'd like to learn, because sometimes there's one that I want to find and it's not there, and other times things pop up really quick, so I'm like, who's getting it in there? So if anyone out there listening knows how you get a GIF into the searches, and I know that Facebook and Twitter have different searches as well.
Yeah.
You
know,
yeah.
There's layers going on here. Let us know. Let us know how we can make that happen. Speaking of social media, would smartphones and social media ruin this movie?
So I had a couple.
I think Caitlin wouldn't even turn up to the quick stop. I think she'd just, you know, it'd be a FaceTime message and, you know, that's about it, or a FaceTime call.
Yeah,
perhaps, although they talk every night. Like, she shows up because, I mean, I guess knowing that she could perhaps get onto him much more easily than the next time they arrange to talk on the phone of an evening would make a difference there.
But if you had a mobile phone, she could get in touch with him then and there, sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
She probably couldn't get to
him.
She
probably
wouldn't take... therefore, she headed down there.
She probably wouldn't take the eight-hour bus ride or whatever it was, train ride.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much conversation in this film, so much face-to-face interactions that I feel like you would lose a lot with smartphones and social media. Like, all the conversations that happen with the girlfriend would probably happen via text, you know, even like the drug deals that are happening outside the quick stop would be happening via text.
That's true. Although I don't know that, like, if you made this movie today, I don't know if those things would seem out of place necessarily. Like, yes, they could happen via social media or text message or whatever, but, you know, the girlfriend showing up to the store or drug deals outside, I don't know. I feel like they could still fly today and not be too out of place.
I wonder, would Randall and Dante have as much interaction, though? Because I feel like if you're a clerk and you're bored and you have the time, you'd probably be scrolling through Twitter or something rather than,
that's true,
oh, I'm going to go see what this guy's up to.
Yeah, they'd probably just be texting back and forth as they scroll through their social media. Yeah. Although that is where Dante would see the engagement message. It'd be like on Facebook,
yeah,
rather than in the yeah paper.
So he'd be like ringing up Facebook and saying, is there a mistake?
Get me Mark Zuckerberg.
Report this post as suspicious.
Yeah. One thing I did have here is that Caitlin probably wouldn't have fucked the dead guy because she'd have a light on her phone.
Yes, and, that's true.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have to,
I didn't think of
to
that,
take a, you know, take a piss in the dark.
Yeah. So smartphone may have fixed the movie.
but then the guy that went into the back with the porno mag, he probably wouldn't have gone with the porno mag, but he would have had his phone instead. That's so
true. He still might have died.
He's probably still might have died, but
I feel like Randall would have lost his job long ago if social media existed, because there'd be that many more ways for people to complain about him and film him and kind of
yeah
catch him in the act of being rude to customers. I don't know if anyone could possibly talk to people the way,
I mean, even just Yelp reviews, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The clerk was horrible.
The boss, like, checking in on them, like, occasionally on the phone in the shop. Like, I think he would have a security camera set up that he can monitor from an app on his phone and see that they're sitting behind the counter or they're selling drugs to four-year-old kids. And
with clerks like that, you definitely want your security camera up. Yep.
Absolutely. Could you make Clerks in 2019, and what would the 2019 version be?
Jane Silent Bob reboot.
I had similar answer. I had Clerks 3, which is something that very nearly got made. Mm-hmm. They're doing a table reading for it soon.
He just talked about the plans for Clerks 3. Because of where Jane Silent Bob reboot leave Jane Silent Bob at the end, he really wants to go back, rewrite Clerks 3, get Jeff Anderson back on board, and leave Dante and Randall in much the same sort of position that, you know, you can see where they'd be going forward, because the original Clerks 3 was very, very bleak and about death. So he goes, he loves the script that he wrote, but he can sort of see that it didn't do right by the characters. So he is still looking at doing a new version of Clerks 3, but also reading through the original script for Clerks 3 around his birthday.
Interesting. Why hasn't this movie been made? Because I feel like, yes, it might not be something studios see as a viable project, but we're in a Kickstarter age. Kevin Smith has so much fan support.
It was all because of Jeff Anderson, actually. He wasn't happy with what happened after Clerks 2. Basically, he never got money for it, basically, even though it made bank, and made all its budget back and all that sort of stuff. It was held up in, purgatory for a long time, so it took them until, 2015 or something like that to actually get paid for
How's that possible? I didn't know that's bizarre.
Oh, it's all the fact that if you actually have a look into the way that Hollywood money actually works, there's so much in marketing and all this sort of stuff, and everyone else gets paid before the talent when it comes to back ends sort of thing.
Okay.
So it's really, really weird. But also, I don't think Jeff Anderson was very happy with being involved with the Weinsteins again, and because the Weinsteins actually own Clerks itself.
Oh, yeah.
That could be a barrier going ahead. Mm. Or are they not an issue anymore?
I think he's
dealt with, they're not involved?
They own Clerks itself, just like Universal own Mallrats, but Kevin and Jay both own Jay and Silent Bob together, so they can sort of use Jay and Silent Bob for whatever they want, but Clerks, they've got to actually give first preference to the Weinsteins.
Right.
But it's something that there's a weird thing that goes on there, that they can actually still do the movie, but they just have to give first rights to the Weinsteins to actually distribution and that sort of stuff.
So I guess it's been a minute, 13 years since Clerks 2, but if we can use that as a kind of a barometer, I think that proved that there is a way to kind of remake the same movie, essentially. Yeah. You have to find a way to make these guys in a new position in their life, but still the same characters and facing the grown-up version of whatever their issues were at the time. So And I know I've heard Kevin say, like, Clerks was a movie about being in his 20s. Clerks 2 was a movie about being in his 30s. By the time Clerks 3 comes out, maybe it's a movie about being in your late 40s or 50s.
Late 40s.
Yeah. And still working as a clerk? I don't know. But that's maybe it's their kids are clerks? I don't know.
Yeah, but they do own the Quickstop. Right. As of the end of Clerks 2, spoiler, they do own the Quickstop.
True.
They got out of the movies and headed back over to the Quickstop, where they now own their own business. Yeah. They work for themselves, which is where he wanted to leave them, that they sort of had a future.
Sure.
So interestingly about making the movie today, my mind actually went more to, if you're making a movie about clerks in their 20s today, like what's that going to look like? And I mean, for one of them is not going to be working in a video store. And it'd be color because it'd be filmed on an iPhone. But it does, like, are there movies coming out? Like, it surprises me that there aren't, and maybe there aren't, I'm just not familiar with them, but aren't filmmakers today who are just doing that super low budget and making movies like this that are just clever and, you know, I guess they'd put them up on YouTube and get a following or whatever. Like, I sort of, obviously there are filmmakers who do that, but it doesn't feel the same as this, where it's just the snappy script and it's like super basic, but it just works because it's something a bit different, you know?
Yeah, I guess you'd really have to delve into like film buff territory to know what the equivalent is today, because that was such a time where, you know, we mentioned Quentin Tarantino, and obviously Spike Lee was doing his thing and he got a shout out in the credits for kind of blazing the trail for this type of film to get made. So maybe it's just a different time now where something becomes a hit amongst a smaller subsection of people, or maybe it's a really successful movie in Australia or in Canada, but it doesn't have the mass success that this did.
It's true. It probably just is, you know, stuff on YouTube, right? Like people putting up sketches or putting up, I guess it's less common to see just someone, you know, do a whole feature film and throw it up on YouTube, but that's because of the way media has changed. You know, there are definitely plenty of comedy creators out there who start in their backyard and put it up on YouTube and get popular. So,
I mean, what I find really quite interesting is the last film to really get a full theatrical release here from Kevin Smith was actually Zack and Miri. Like, after that, I mean, there was Red State, Tusk and Yoga Hoses, but they didn't get a full theatrical release because he didn't have the sort of draw power here in Australia anymore. So, if he can't get, you know, a wide release, then you're not going to get a wide release from any sort of indie here in Australia. You got to rely on the Astor or something like that.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting how Kevin Smith has sort of gone back into being much more of an indie filmmaker in a lot of ways. He did that on purpose because he was over movie making for the big studios and then, you know, got way into podcasting and then the movies kind of came out of that. But like so much of his stuff recently has been lower budget and limited release and, you know, just making the movies he wants to make. So Reboot. I mean, Reboot is actually a big departure from what he's been doing in recent years.
And I think it's a shame. Like, I don't know. I haven't seen any of those movies that you mentioned, those kind of lower budget ones, Red State, Tusk and Yoga Hoses. They didn't look like my style. But I think he's got so much to say as a, you know, not only personality, but as a writer and someone that's been through a lot in his life. And we've always seen his experiences thrown up onto the big screen in an interesting and funny way. So I really hope he does get back to, you know, working with Jason Lee and Jay and Silent Bob. And
well, he got Affleck back for Reboot, so that's something.
Yeah, it's a sign that he hasn't forgotten about that universe and how much people love it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
From what he was saying, like, if you have a look at the sort of cameo and big sort of cast numbers for the first Jay and Silent Bob, there were 22 cards at the end for the big ticket cameos / stars. There's 44 in Reboot.
Oh, jeez.
So he's managed to get that many like callbacks and people coming back, which is just amazing to sort of see. That's what happens in a post heart attack.
Kevin Smith world. And I think he's just good at making friends in the industry in a lot of ways. Yeah. Like,
Yep.
He's just an affable guy and he's very genuine and yeah, he's people like to work with him, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so useless trivia. There's 91 F-bombs in this movie. Is that surprising?
No.
How many C-bombs?
At least one that I can remember, yeah. But you mentioned there was a couple.
I think there's like three or four.
I think there's three or four in that one sentence with the video titles. So.
Yeah.
So you mentioned before about the soundtrack budget, Trevor. I think I've got here the film's final cost was $230,000 once the rights were covered. And I guess adding, you know, Bad Religion and some of those kind of punk bands and that kind of thing costs like five times as much, or ten times as much as the original budget, just about.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the trivia. We already talked about the alternate ending that got cut, so I won't go into that one. Let's move on to the Steve Buscemi Spark Plug Award. This is a tough one because there's so many little, you know, appearances and characters, and all those people are kind of just either Kevin's friends or relatives. So I think that Jay and Silent Bob both qualify for this. I feel like I want to give it to Jason Mewes. Is there any other contenders?
I kind of like all the characters that Walt Flanagan plays. I think he's just got this sort of way of just walking in. It's like, pack of cigarettes, you know? And it's like, he plays all these different characters and he's one of the people that I keep on looking out for in all the different scenes because he's just...
It's a fun game.
Particularly as a Kevin Smith buff.
A funny guy.
You know, you do notice.
Yeah.
You do notice the friends.
But yeah, I reckon Jason is pretty...
Yeah, good. I think I agree that Jay, particularly just for the impact he's then had on the rest of Kevin's, you know, movies and you know, obviously they're based around him as a major character in a big way from that point onwards. But I think that's...
I mean, in the sense of, you know, the award being a spark plug award, it's hard to go past him. He might be in the movie too much, but I think I'm going to give it to him anyway. But shout out to the Russian cousin as well, because...
Yes.
What a performance.
Olaf.
What a performance.
Would you like
Olaf.
Some making fuck? Berserker.
Berserker.
Oh, it's a classic. And I'm guessing...
Would you like to suck my...
I think if you like put into YouTube like metal cover, there would be so many metal bands.
Oh, God,
You might know, Trevor, but of people actually like drawing that into a full-length song or something.
Oh, it's been done. I actually listened to it yesterday.
Yeah, there you go. I knew it.
There's lyrics for everything. Yeah. Like it's.
Oh man!
And in fact, if you actually listen in the movie, there is an audio version in the film. That's also what I listened to, the original version.
I think Kevin Smith helped write the lyrics to that, according to the credits.
Yeah.
Great. So, last question: is it still a good movie? I had yes. I said it's lost the shock value of being outrageous and hilarious, but I think it really, as I mentioned before, holds up probably better as a statement of the early 20s than as a pure comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like I said, a lot of the jokes still hit me, whether that was nostalgia or not. But as a movie as a whole, definitely, I feel like it holds up quite well.
Yeah, being that unlike you guys, it was actually the first foray into Kevin Smith. I do have, you know, sort of the rose-tinted glasses with this one. But yeah, 100% it holds up. Like, not so much as a comedy, as you said, but it still makes me chuckle.
Yeah. And I mean, it is different from the other movies we're covering so far, where it's not this huge comic talent like Jim Carrey or Adam Sandler. It's really Kevin Smith, the person that's written the movie, that's kind of the big name attached to this. And it holds up as a Kevin Smith movie more than anything because it's got that kind of pathos. It's got that kind of, you know, serious undertones of what, like, how life can be hard and what it's like to be in your 20s and struggling and not knowing how to have a good relationship and what that looks like. So I think that, you know, not being content with your job, feeling like you're better than where you are, but not being willing to change the situation. That's a theme that comes up again in Clerks 2. And I think that when you pair this with Clerks 2 is when it really works the best, I think. And you get that kind of continuity and sense of these characters and the depth that this is where they started, this is where they ended up.
Especially because Clerks 2 opens with that black and white scene that makes it feel like it's, you know, almost the next day.
Yeah.
Yes, you know that it's like, you know, a few years later, but it could literally be the next day and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Then they jump forward in time to them working at the movies. So
yeah,
it could literally be a direct continuation. So I think you're definitely right there. The Clerks 1 and 2 work together so nicely.
I'm going to have to go rewatch Clerks 2 now.
Yeah, we will eventually get to 2000s movies on this show after we've covered the 90s and 80s, I think.
Feel free to have us back for Mallrats, Chasing Amy and Dogma. Yeah.
I might have to share it around. There's a few Kevin Smith fans, but I'll definitely be knocking on your door when we get to some of those, indeed. So thank you, dear listeners, for checking out the podcast. As always, the iTunes reviews go a really long way to helping us get out, getting discovered, getting up with those iTunes charts.
Podchaser reviews are amazing,
yeah,
too.
Podchaser reviews anywhere you can review. I don't know, there's not enough places to do it, but Podchaser and iTunes are two of them, so do that, help us out, put a smile on our dials, and of course just subscribing, telling your friends, it really does make a big difference. This is a new podcast, so we're essentially starting from zero and trying to watch the numbers go up, so we thank you for listening. And as always, you can catch 8-Bit on We Are 8-Bit. You can catch both Ben and Trevor on BitStorm Podcast. I know you're not big Twitter users, but where's the best place for people to catch you on social media?
So you can just hit up BitStormCast on either Facebook or Twitter, and you can go to podchaser.com/BitStorm, and all the episodes are there and links to other things. So.
Brilliant. Well, you can find me at Jono himself. Thank you for joining us on Comedy Rewind. And as always, dear listeners, be kind.